Welcome to The Author Meets the Critics, where today's guest is David Bradley, author of one of the most controversial books of our time, No Place to Hide. In a moment, Dr. Bradley will meet his critics, who are Norman Cohen and James F. Burns, Jr., in a free-for-all about his new book. But first, meet the man who keeps the peace on these programs, your regular chairman, John K. M. McCaffrey.
Good afternoon, everyone. In July 1946, Dr. David Bradley was one of the thousands who participated in Operation Crossroads, the dropping of the atomic bomb at Bikini. His was the task of finding out the bomb's immediate after effects on ships, islands, seaports, harbors, and human beings. Convinced that the published reports available to the average man have given him an incomplete story, Dr. Bradley has published his day-by-day account of what did happen at Bikini and his interpretation of what the results of the test mean to each of us. Here to give us a brief statement of his findings and the conclusion he drew from them is our author, Dr. David Bradley.
Thanks, John. You've asked me to make a statement concerning this book, No Place to Hide. Perhaps I am the poorest one qualified to make such a statement. It is like expecting a father to be objective about his daughter, and that's almost impossible. The book is obviously not a critique of military problems and policies, although there are some who interpret it as such. It is not a document for world government, except insofar as any consideration of modern weapons of mass destruction argues persuasively in that direction. The book is by no means a scientific treatise. There are unquestionably many inaccuracies in it. These I will not dispute. I doubt if all such inaccuracies will add up to any significant changes in the general picture, namely that the atomic bomb is a weapon, both because of the order of magnitude of its destructive force, and because the advent of radioactivity as a weapon against healthy people instead of a tool with which we can help the sick. Some people argue that my book is a persuasive argument that we should go to war right now while we have a monopoly of atomic power. Having reread the book last night, I must say that this argument is too obscure for me to see. To me, the conclusions, if any, mean that the prosperity of this country is intimately connected with the prosperity of Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and all the rest of the people. I would think that of all projects the American people undertake, war should be the last, inasmuch as it may be their last.
Thank you, Dr. Bradley, and now for the criticism. First, an eminent New York attorney and formerly one of the naval advisors to James F. Burns at the first Foreign Ministers Conference, Mr. James F. Murray, Jr.
I hope Jimmy Burns won't resent my having been presented as James F. Burns, Jr. at the beginning of this program.
I didn't catch that, Mr. Murray. I will make you Secretary of State soon.
Well, don't hold your breath. This is an extremely interesting book that Dr. Bradley has written. It's a sincere documentation of his personal experiences at the threshold of the atomic age. I think everyone should read this book, and that may sound strange coming from a critic. However, I'm forced to disagree most severely with some of the conclusions and implications in the book. The possession of the secret of the atomic bomb is probably the greatest moral responsibility that this country has ever had, or perhaps ever will have. It's my opinion that in releasing information, which is vital to the retention of this secret, our government leaders, in conjunction with our scientists and our military and political advisors, should proceed with the greatest possible caution in order that, while advising and informing our citizens, they do not release vital and dangerous information into the hands of those who might find no moral scruples in using it against us.
Thank you, and for quite a different opinion, the well-known radio dramatist and winner of the One World Award, Mr. Norman Corwin.
Well, the optimists among us who have been lulled by the fact that no new atom bombs have been tested lately, at least none that we know about, can now unlull themselves because only the most hopeless Pollyanna can believe after reading No Place to Hide that atomic warfare is nice, clean sport and that you can keep your health and your friends by ducking into a bomb shelter or staying away from a city that's been atomized. Now, long before this book came out, I, for one, was powerfully impressed by the report that shortly after the first bomb was tested in New Mexico, A batch of photographic film in Rochester, New York, 2,000 miles away, was spoiled by radiation. That was not a violation of military security or the release of information that would be harmful to the safety of this country. This came out in the press. What Dr. Bradley's book accomplishes is to tell, through the eyes of an expert who was at Bikini measuring radiation, just how lingering and penetrating and poisonous are the after effects of an exploded bomb. That's pretty much all the book sets out to do. The title, No Place to Hide, is an accurate statement of the book's theme and conclusion, that there is no real defense against atomic weapons, that there are no satisfactory countermeasures or methods of decontamination, that there are no satisfactory medical safeguards for the people of atomized areas, and that the influence of the bomb and its byproducts can destroy and poison people and land and the produce of land, not only for the duration of any reasonably long war, but for centuries. The message and warning of the book alone are enough to make it important. But in addition to this, the book, in the form of a diary, is written with warmth, with charm, humanity, and humor. Dr. Bradley is a scientist with a poet's heart, just as Shelley was a poet with a scientist's heart. And best of all, it seems to me, he has a social conscience to go along with his skill, his knowledge, and his power of observation.
All right, Mr. Murray, it's obviously unnecessary for you to put your hatchet back now that you've got it out on the table. Do you wish to use it on Mr. Corwin?
Well, I'm glad that Mr. Corwin, as the nucleus of his pro-critique, took the 4 points which Dr. Bradley saw fit to enumerate in the latter part of his book as the main reasons why the present United States policy worries him. And I'd like to analyze them briefly for you. My own point of view, they hold partially true now. I wish to point out I'm not a scientist, and I hope that Doctor won't feel I'm treading over onto his ground where he is the expert and none of us here could possibly be. But he points out that there is no real defense against the atomic weapons. Well, I'll take his word for that. Perhaps there is no real defense at the present time, but I'm not willing to assume that the same scientific minds that found and developed the atomic weapon will not, somehow, in some way, find some measure of defense against it. Now, I remember at Anzio when the Germans surprised us with their, what we call, robot torpedoes, their aerial control torpedoes. For a time, we thought there was no defense against it, and we lost a good number of ships. But very shortly after that, they found that by jamming the radio waves which control the bomb itself in air, they could throw it completely out of commission. In other words, the point is that I feel some measure of countermeasure, if there can be a play on words, will be forthcoming.
Mr. Corwin?
I think that Mr. Murray, by that statement, qualifies as one of the hopeless Pollyannas that I spoke about earlier, because to say that great defense against atomic warfare will be developed because other defenses have been developed is to indulge in the most optimistic and hopeless kind of speculation. So far, there has been none. Even if countermeasures are affected, it's going to be very, very rough going. I'm sure there are countermeasures against ordinary bombs, the V-bombs, the rocket bombs, the blockbusters of the last war, but it's still pretty tough. I would like, if I may, Mr. McCaffrey, to classify this kind of thinking with a statement by a scientist who was very outspoken against Dr. Bradley's thesis that radiation isn't so hard. I want to quote from a piece that he had in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. He undertakes to dispel some of the fear of radiation. He says...
Who is this man, Mr.?
This is Austin Bruce, if I have his name correctly, B-R-U-E-S. He says, perhaps we can take the bloom off the serious nature of radiation by pointing out that no radiation effect exists which cannot be duplicated by the action of some known drug or chemical. Well, that's dandy, but we just don't spray those drugs or chemicals around broadside by atomic bombs. And millions of people are not affected by the chemicals that are able to duplicate the effects of radiation.
Mr. Murray.
Well, first of all, I'd like to clarify, what are we trying to prove here? If Mr. Corwin is assuming that I, for one, and I'm sure the great majority of those in the audience, do not realize that war of any kind is tough, why, then there's just no argument. We're agreed on that. It's obvious. All of us I'm sure each and every one of us are absolutely opposed and hope in our hearts that we'll never have to go through any kind of war again, whether it be atomic or otherwise. But my contention is simply this. Those of us who have been fairly close to the bomb, and one of us at least who has been intimate with this new discovery, should not allow ourselves to be persuaded out of reason by the awesome implications and complications of this discovery to the point where we surrender the very secret which now is ours alone. Now look what we've done so far. We have the monopoly on the bomb. We discovered it. We produced it. We used it with success. And contrary to all historical precedent, as soon as the war was over, we made the magnanimous, and I'm perfectly sure sincere, offer to allow our secret to become a part and parcel of United Nations control, asking only the minimum possible security guarantee. This was rejected. Now, my contention simply reduces itself to the following, that until we can be absolutely sure that we won't be sabotaging and torpedoing ourselves and the civilization for which we as a democratic country stand, then it's perfectly academic to talk about releasing bomb information as if we weren't aware of its implications, only on the grounds that war is terrible and that atomic war will be an awesome and fearsome thing.
Mr. Garland.
Well, Dr. Bradley isn't proposing that we release any such information. There's no such suggestion made in the book. And all he's doing is saying that the military should not conceal from the people that certain facts, terrible and awesome facts about atomic warfare, are established. And I see no reason for whistling in the dark or whistling in the sunlight and saying that, after all, it can't be so terrible. Dr. Bradley's book does not discuss the Baruch plan or any of the international ramifications of the control of atomic energy. And he just stays away from that. The word, the nasty word Russia does not appear anywhere in his book. And I think that's another program at another time and another station.
Well, that's the very implication that I'm referring to, namely, as Mr. Cohen said, that the military shouldn't, I think I've quoted him correctly, the military shouldn't conceal the awesome facts. Well, now, the military don't have these facts anymore. As I recall, the Atomic Energy Commission is a civilian organization. And as I further recall, and I think I'm correct, it's President Truman himself who is refusing to release even the minimum report on atomic information on the results of radiation. I agree with this policy. I can't see where we would be fulfilling or they would be fulfilling their moral obligation towards the American people to release this vital information one moment before they are absolutely sure that it won't be in some way used against us. We're aware of the effects of the bomb in general, and I dare say, in fact, this book points out that unless one has good scientific background, it's perfectly useless to try and convince us of the scientific details which few of us can comprehend anyway.
Well, I think that perhaps some of these questions which Mr. Murray has raised should be answered by our author of the afternoon himself, whose appearance on this program is a unique experience for me since I grew up with Dave Bradley. We were both the sons of professors at the University of Wisconsin. We courted the same girl. She was a wise and discriminating maiden, however.
And didn't marry either of us.
She didn't marry either of us. Choosing not to accept the insecurity of life with a mad radio commentator or a man who might begin counting emotions with a Geiger counter. But this is the first time I've seen Dave Bradley in approximately 20 years. So this is kind of old lang syne, old home week, and to the stirring strains of On Wisconsin, here is our author of the afternoon, Dr. David Bradley.
Thanks again, John. There are many questions you would like me to answer, and in a short time, I don't see how I can do them all. One is the implication by Mr. Murray that my book contains vital and dangerous information which might get into the hands of people who would use it against us. I'm perfectly sure that because I'm no authority on the real secrets of atomic energy, that nothing has appeared in this book which can possibly be used against us, unless it is our own ignorance of these facts. As you know, this book was cleared by the Atomic Energy Commission. They saw in it, they saw fit to change only a few lines. It would seem to me that it would be impossible to tackle even a civilian defense plan without at least a basic understanding by the people at large of the problems of radiation, so that when they are being pushed around by police and military, they will understand why it has to be done that way. This is very clear in the civil defense report written under the direction of Secretary Forrestal, the so-called Hopley Report. It would be impossible even to set up a civil defense plan, let alone have any intelligent understanding of foreign policy, without a pretty fair understanding of what the weapon is. Now, I would agree absolutely with Mr. Murray that there should not, that people's information should not come from unofficial sources such as mine. As I can't kid you, John. You know that I'm a crackpot anyway. Why should they turn to me? I believe very wholeheartedly that the Atomic Energy Commission will get out information much more accurate than mine, much more to the point, and we are attending on that very production of publication in a few months. Meantime, I think Mr. Truman can go a long way by making a clear-cut statement as to why he is sitting on the so-called Joint Chiefs of Staff's report. I don't believe with Mr. Murray that it contains a great many scientific facts of any consequence. I don't know what Mr. Truman is withholding it for, and I don't believe that Mr. Murray does. And until we know what's in the report, we cannot judge it. Perhaps he has very good reasons for withholding it, and I believe that he should say so. In addition, though, I will always continue to worry about those things which are not released, because I know that a very small part of the real truth will ever be released from official sources. And as an outsider, I shall continue to worry about the things which have not been told us.
Well, how many of those things, Dr. Bradley, do you think can be told to us without endangering military security or political security, however you want to define either one of those two terms?
Well, we've set up a great institution, the Atomic Energy Commission, for declassification of material. And it seems to me that they are the people best able to judge what ought to be withheld and which should not. Now, this report was passed by them as far as scientific and technological secrets, if you wish to call them, in that regard at least. It has been withheld for other reasons, and I don't know those reasons.
Mr. Murray, do you have any idea of what those reasons
are? Well, I just want to correct one impression. I really did not say, I'm sure, or imply, that in my opinion this book contained classified material, the release of which was improper. Quite the contrary. I commended the book for the way it handled a very delicate and serious problem. What I did criticize was the implications in the book that kind of information might well be released at a given time without endangering our national security. Certainly, I don't know what's in the Truman Report, but having served in certain capacities with our government and with some of its present leaders, I'm perfectly content as a non-expert to allow the governmental leaders, with the advice of their experts, and I find Doctor and I have one expert at least who is a mutual friend, I'm perfectly content to allow them to make the decision. I think they know best, and I don't think they should be stampeded. This is an awesome thing. It's a permanent thing. We have it with us. We shouldn't become terrorized or stampeded, but at the same time, I agree with Doctor that we shouldn't be too complacent about it. I think the men who know best should be allowed to decide.
Mr. Corman.
I don't see that there is any a big issue here. Both Dr. Bradley and Mr. Murray are bowing to each other furiously, saying that we agree that there is no classified material in this book, and that others should give it out, proper official sources should give it out, and they're in great harmony about this.
Except for the fact that Dr. Bradley doesn't feel that anyone should impede the flow of information from the Atomic Energy Commission, that if it has been passed by that commission, that there's no reason for any governmental source to hold it back.
That's not right, John.
Well, sounds just like 20 years ago. Go ahead, Dave.
After all, President Truman is the boss around here, and he may have very good reasons. I think he could allay a lot of fears by telling us some of the reasons, rather than just passing it off and saying, I'm sorry, boys, to this newspaper man, I can't say anything about this.
Well, we have to leave that to the future and to President Truman to decide what is the best time and how much information he can give out at that time.
I think it's very kind of us to leave that to President Truman at this time.
Well, of course, there is no place to hide, and the President, I assume, ultimately will come out with this information, or with as much as he feels is secure. But I do think that one of the great contributions of this book is to impress upon the public
a fact which has not been clear to the public entirely up to now, and that is the extent of the dangers of radioactivity. The public consciousness of the bomb is something which has been indoctrinated by the newsreel photographs of these tremendous mushroom clouds, this tremendous explosion which flings ships around as though they were little cork stoppers. And the aftermath, which is the terrible thing, which is the lingering, poisonous, deadly, insidious thing, has been entirely overlooked or almost de-emphasized. Dr. Bradley emphasizes this, and he tells us, for example, I just have cataloged some of these things because listeners who haven't read the book might be curious to know that poisoned by radioactivity after the bomb, and for months after the bomb, exploded at Bikini, where the air, to the extent that the crews in airplanes had to wear masks flying thousands of feet above the site of the bomb explosion, the water, the ships, the water intakes, the evaporators, the toilet and fire lines on the ships, the barnacles clinging to the side of the ships, steel plates, wooden decks, caulking in the deck seams, rust spots on the metal, oil slicks, which had particularly heavy radioactivity, oil slicks which traveled in the water 200 miles away from the scene, coral, which turned from pink to white, turning my hair from brown to gray, small fish, bigger fish, which ate the smaller fish, sand dredged up from the bottom, the shoes of crewmen who walked on the decks, their clothes, even the instruments which measure radioactivity became radioactive. I think that's horrible.
Yeah, if the attorney might interject, I'd like to see that quoted page and number. I don't remember any of that being described as existing months after. In fact, it was quite the contrary.
May I correct that? You're wrong on that, Mr. Murray. I enjoyed listening.
Mr. Corwin.
Corwin, yes. A good many things that you said there are accurate. The one about the dust in the air, or the possibility of poison particles in the air, was only for a very short while. That is, immediately following the bomb. It is true that in the corridors of the ships, that remained as a possibility from dust that was scuffed up from the floor. But we must get that part of it straight at least.
Well, did you mean, Dr. Bradley, to de-emphasize as much as you did the actual physical destruction done by the ship, but done to the ships at Bikini?
I didn't mean to de-emphasize anything, John. That has appeared in many reports, especially the strategic bombing report, as you know. Now, that's pretty well emphasized. And anything I might have said on that regard would have been out of order because I don't understand blast destructions, and it would have been classified and would never have gotten through anyway.
Well, I give you the air above the lagoon, Dr. Bradley, gladly. But tell me, were these other items highly contaminated?
They were highly contaminated.
And did the poison linger for a long time?
Yes, it's still there. It's a question of how dangerous is it now. I think your statement that it was dangerous for months certainly will hold most rigorous scientific scrutiny.
The plaintiff rests.
Mr. Murray?
Well, I can't agree in full with certain sentences in the conclusion of this book, which I think in a way may sum up Doctor's entire opinion. For example, he said the greatest failure of all in these tests has been in apprehending their sociological implications. Evidently, the bomb has failed to impress more than a few congenital pessimists with the full scope of its lethal potential. Well, maybe it has failed to impress some of Doctor's friends, but it certainly hasn't gone unheeded among my friends. And I must say that living close to this kind of work might give one a different perspective than an attorney, for example, or an unscientific man. I find that certain scientists have not taken the pains and trouble, or perhaps have not the skill, to write as fine a book as this describing this kind of potential. But certainly, from my own observations, the people at large, although unaware or unable to comprehend the scientific aspects, are fully aware of it in a general way, and I think this book will help them be aware in a particular way.
Well, there's been a great deal of suggestion that I have started panic, and yet my feeling is that for every person who feels any anxiety, there are probably 1,000 or 10,000 who have nothing but complete indifference to the subject. I have not noticed any panic at all, and I fear indifference ever so much more than panic.
Well, aren't we up against the problem of human nature there, Doctor? I recall during the war seeing people absolutely indifferent in Europe pasturing their herds during the invasion at Salerno, completely indifferent to everything. That's human nature. We all learn to become indifferent to the greatest dangers after a certain time.
Poor old human nature. What a beating it's had to take. I don't know about Dr. Bradley's friends and Mr. Murray's friends and whether they were impressed or not impressed by the bomb, but I think that a very large area of the press has not been impressed by the dangers of the bomb. Otherwise, they wouldn't be so hungry for war. There has been a good deal of rattling of the sword on both sides of the Atlantic, and I will look to General George Marshall for the formula to prevent war. He says the only way to be sure of winning the next war is to prevent it. And I think this should be understood within the context of atomic energy and atomic warfare.
Mr. Murray.
I'd just like to take exception to the fact, to the statement, that the large part of the press is hungry for war. I don't think there's any grounds whatsoever for that statement.
Well, I think there is grounds, and we differ on it, and we'd have to have reams of clippings to decide this issue.
I think our men in the press are just the same way we are in our frame of mind. They differ
not
on
all,
minor things.
Not all
I
men.
I doubt that they're hungry for war.
Not
I don't
all
agree
the
with
men
that.
In the press. Not
Can
all
I raise one
Dave.
Question here before the time runs out, and that is this suggestion by Mr. Murray that there is a secret. We don't have any secret. The fundamental scientific knowledge is understood by all modern civilized countries or people in them. The secret, if it exists, purely is a technological one of how to build a building that will make atomic bombs, and no one can suggest that that will not happen in the very near future in any civilized country. The suggestion that we may develop defenses is certainly true. There will be defenses, but do they add up to a whole lot? Dr. Oppenheimer, in testifying before the Congress, said that our bombs cannot be exploded before they reach their destination. Many persons squirm and try to say that there is a countermeasure. There will never be a countermeasure, to which Dr. Curtis adds, we can offer no hope of specific defense against atomic bombs, nor will counteroffensive warfare restore the ruins of our cities or revive the millions of our dead. And that's a position that I, as a doctor, take. I'm not interested in these statistics which tell me how many 20,000 or 40,000 people will be injured, because I'm the person who will have to help take care of them.
Well, isn't it a maxim in medical schools, however, Dr. Bradley, that always and never are two words that you should always never use?
I would just say at this point that I'd like to agree with what I heard General Kenny say at one time, that the best defense to atomic attack is to have 100 more planes and 100 more bombs than the other side. Now, that may sound harsh and it may sound too realistic, but we're living in a harsh, realistic world. And I propose that we keep the advantage and not give it away to other people.
Well, what happens, say, 2 years from now, Mr. Murray, when Russia or France
I'm not
or
mentioning
England...
any powers,
no, Russia or France or England or Siam has a factory which will produce...
No question but what they will, but I think that we should keep the know-how and keep the lead in the know-how, and not directly or indirectly through panic or fear or good motive give away any of our national heritage, which will allow us to keep the lead in the know-how, whatever it might be at that time.
Mr. Corwin, do you? Yes,
I want this country to have the know-how, and I want it to keep the lead, too. But as Dr. Bradley pointed out in a speech he gave recently, this country is spending $15 million annually for the United Nations and $15 billion annually for military preparedness, a ratio of $1,000 for military power to every single dollar spent for international cooperation. Now, stand that up against General Marshall's statement that the only way to be sure of winning the next war is to prevent it. You don't prevent it by having 100 more planes. You prevent it by preventing war.
And perhaps the way to do that is through education, and if you want to spend a little money for education, you could go out and spend $2 to buy No Place to Hide.
Oh, you can get it for 2 bits now, John.
Oh, really? Well, I'm sorry, gentlemen. The time's up for both the author and his critics. And here is Arthur Gary to tell you what lies ahead on the program.
Next week, The Author Meets the Critics returns to the New York stage for its literary tug of war. Our guest author will be Clifford Odets in the play The Big Knife, which opened this past Thursday evening. Be sure to be with us next Sunday when Clifford Odets meets his critics face to face. And now, back to John McCaffrey.
Before closing, I'd like to thank Dr. David Bradley for coming here today to discuss his book, No Place to Hide. To thank you, Norman Corwin, and you, James F. Murray, Jr., for joining us. This is John McCaffrey saying good afternoon for The Author Meets the Critics.
The Author Meets the Critics has come to you from the RCA Exhibition Hall in Radio City and is produced by Martin Stone and directed by Lee Jones. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.